on your mobile apps on 97.8 and now on DAB. This is Gateway.
From the Sky News Centre at 5, Pope Francis's dedication to the poor, to refugees and marginalised communities is being remembered in tributes following his death aged 88. The Pope left hospital last month where he'd spent 5 weeks receiving treatment for double pneumonia. But just a few hours before his passing, he'd blessed Easter Sunday crowds in St Peter's Square yesterday. Archbishop of Westminster Cardinal Vincent Nicholas told journalists despite his recent ill health, the news came as a surprise.
I was driving up the M1, or one of your agencies rang me and said the Pope has died, and I said, you're joking, because I really did not expect after yesterday.
Crowds are gathering again at the Vatican to pay their respects.
It's just a very sad day. I think impressive that he made it to Easter. I think that's almost like a miracle for Italy.
It's pretty much devastated all of us.
While some argue his apologies for abuse in the church wasn't enough, many praise him for allowing priests to bless same-sex couples. Leaders from across the world have issued statements in reaction to his death. The King says the Pope Francis profoundly touched the lives of so many. At the White House, US President Donald Trump says he's ordered state and federal flags to be flown at half-mast.
In honor of Pope Francis, so he was a good man, worked hard. He loved the world, and it's an honor to do that.
Pope Francis' death triggers a week-long process of final respects and a funeral before the eventual election of a new pope. In other news, Russia's president says fighting in Ukraine's resumed after an Easter ceasefire. Both sides accused each other of breaking it multiple times. And in sport, Leeds have done their part in clinching promotion from their championship in some style by thrashing Stoke 6-0. They'll seal a return to the Premier League at the first attempt if Sheffield United fail to get victory at second place Burnley in the late kickoff. That's the latest. I'm Leisha McKenna.
Nice parking, Sam. And here comes Tanya on a bike, off to French class.
Hiya!
Sam, so your car door doesn't hit Tanya when you get out. If you can, open it with the hand furthest from it, so you'll see who's walking, riding or cycling behind you. Far to go, Tanya?
25 minutes.
Lost on me. Sorry. Whether they're fluent in French or perfecting Portuguese, whoever you meet, travel like you know them.
Merci!
Think. Follow the highway code and let's help keep everyone safe. The highway code rules may vary in Northern Ireland.
All the hits.
I love listening to music. Listen to it all the time.
It just puts a smile on your face.
Now on DAB, across Essex. Across Essex.
All right, you got it.
This is Gateway.
I promise that
Jimmy Mack from Martha Reeves and the Vandellas on Gateway 97.8. Hello, welcome to My Life in Print, the part two with Ada McGurran, who was the managing editor of the Daily Mirror and now is a councillor in Basildon. Good to see you, Aidan.
Good to be back, thank you.
The public demanded more, so here you are.
Happy to give more.
When we were talking before, it was a lot of it was about the stories you covered, some of which were really gruesome, some of which were massively entertaining with the discovering Posh and Beck's latest house. But after being a reporter for so long, you worked your way into management. So how did you sort of first move into management?
So, I mean, again, only in newspapers would you have such a ridiculously quick transition. I, as you say, I've been in reporting at the East of England Daily Mirror Reporter for about 10 years. During a lot of that period, my news editor was a fella called Eugene Duffy, really great journalist, who subsequently became managing editor. I was one of the few reporters in tabloids who was quite interested in the business of the newspapers and the strategy and stuff. So I used to regularly, we were great mates anyway, I used to regularly ring him up and say, why aren't we doing this? Why are we doing that? Basically, the then deputy manager was looking to retire. So Eugene had a word with me and I said, look, I don't know anything about management. He said, well, none of us do. he said, so we'll get you some training courses and all the rest of it. And it was pretty much in at the deep end, I have to say.
Because it's quite common as a reporter to be working on stories, chasing exclusives the whole time. But you don't want to get into management because then you're not writing the stories anymore. You're having to manage them.
It was a big change. It was like, you know, classic poacher turned gamekeeper almost situation. But it was also, I mean, it was also fascinating. It was a really interesting period in newspapers. And and like I say, I think some of the management aspects were really interesting. Unfortunately, we hit a really severe financial crisis in the newspaper world, which led to lots of redundancies and cutbacks. But there were also positives around that time as well.
It's quite common for now, unfortunately, for a newsroom to be making cuts. I mean, we've seen, as we're recording in the last few days, some pretty major cuts in a major newspaper, and I know broadcasters are thinking about the same as well. But when the economic crash came in, that must have been quite a surprise. You know, you're having to lay people off.
Well, my timing was brilliant. So I became deputy managing editor in 2009, just as the real impacts of 2008-2009 global financial crisis were hitting. And one of the things that happened was, like, obviously circulation declines were important, but one of the things that people didn't focus on as much was the advertising revenues fell off a cliff, and tabloid newspapers were incredibly reliant on advertising revenues. So it was a very, very stark financial climate. It required, you know, and the Mirror was part of a PLC, so we didn't have a private owner who was prepared to swallow some of this. We were answerable to shareholders, and all they were bothered about was the bottom line. So inevitably, that leads to quite severe, stringent cuts.
So where do you turn first when you need to save money in a newsroom?
You go for the low-hanging fruit first. anything that can most easily be managed without, you know. And to be fair, you know, in the early part of my editorial management career, there were things that we, you know, had spent money on. You know, when times are good, you can live with it. But when times are a bit more difficult, you have to cut back. But inevitably, it started to lead to job losses and then further job losses. And again, being entirely honest, going back historically, probably not a little bit before my period in editorial management, there had been a time where tabloid newspapers had probably been overstaffed, if I'm being entirely honest. And with technological changes and all the rest of it, it allowed for some cutbacks that weren't as painful. But as time went on, it became more and more painful. You know, if you keep sort of slicing, what we call salami slicing, it becomes very painful after a while.
Columnists are expensive, aren't they?
They are really expensive.
So do they go?
Yeah. I had great pleasure in, actually, he resigned, Tony Parsons, who then moved to The Sun. Had been a successful novelist. I always felt was not a natural bedfellow for the Mirror. I was constantly on the then editor, Lloyd Embley, that we needed to either reduce his fee or get rid of him. And eventually Tony Parsons resigned, so he did us a massive favour.
Also at this point, in 09, you're moving towards the end of Labour in power. Gordon Brown's struggling.
Yeah.
You know the general election's coming. This bright young thing, David Cameron, like him or loathe him, from the other side was getting attention. The pressure's on to I suppose, as a campaigning newspaper, to keep Labour in.
Yeah, absolutely. We tried our best. Obviously, didn't succeed. You know, but I think that, you know. That said, you know, if you remember 2010, it led to a coalition government, so the Conservatives didn't get an overall majority. So we did our best. I think there's a lot we were proud of that we did. We probably limited some of the damage, but the weird thing is, so I remember some of the senior execs going out for a lunch on the day after that election and having a few drinks and drowning our sorrows. But in a weird way, flip side of that is that for the Daily Mirror, it's actually in a way easier and probably you'd do better in terms of retaining readership when the Conservatives in than when Labour are in.
Because you can kick them.
And it's a lot easier and more popular to be kicking the government than be supporting the government, particularly if it's a government. People are going, not sure about this.
I'm finding that a fair bit recently when obviously there's pressures on with Keir Starmer nationally. And as I look at the papers, often on a Sunday morning, for example, you've got every paper's got some criticism of the Prime Minister or the Chancellor. And then the Sunday Mirror's got an interview of the Chancellor talking about how brilliant she is.
Yeah.
It's not as exciting, is it?
No, it's not. It's not as exciting. And you have to try and be a bit more creative about how you do that. And also, you've also got to kind of be a critical friend. So, you know, you can't be too slavishly loyal, particularly when things are going bad. You know, and I think, to be fair to the Mirror, things like the winter fuel allowance, they've done that on that. So you've got to find a balance. You know, obviously, the Mirror's going to be Labour supported. There's been times where some of the senior management of the papers have questioned that, and the editorial staff have gone, just get your tanks off the lawn, please. You're not going there, because it would be ridiculous. It'd be suicidal. So, you know, you've got to find a balance between being supportive but not being slavishly supportive.
So here you are, a deputy managing editor. Would it be fair for me to assume this is the most you've ever earned in the business?
At that point, yeah.
And you're having to cut people at the same time?
Yes, yeah.
That's difficult.
It is difficult, and it's a small industry. And you're getting rid of people that sometimes you know a little bit, sometimes you actually know them quite well. So it's really, really difficult. And even when you don't know them, it's like, you know, you start the process, you sometimes naively think, oh, they'll be okay, because, you know, it's things you shouldn't think, but they're getting on a bit and they'll be all right, you know. But then you don't know the family situation and the personal situation and all of this, and then during the redundancy process, all of that comes out and you end up feeling absolutely terrible.
We'll get into a bit more of that shortly. Let's do a song from Sinead O'Connor. Uh-huh. Tell us what it is and why you picked it.
It's Mandinka, and Sinead's just got an amazing voice, a beautiful voice. And I remember actually, quite a rebellious spirit as well. I remember seeing her after the Warrington bomb. There was a massive peace protest in Dublin. I went to see it. It was just after she'd done the thing, ripping up the picture of the Pope on American TV, so it was like very controversial. And I was in the press pen, and just behind us was two little nuns. Stood there, and she sang this beautiful hymn called "Make Me a Channel of Your Peace," and one of the nuns turned to the other and said, "Ah, she's a good girl, really."
We'll be right back.
Sinead O'Connor on Gateway 97.8. This is My Life in Print. I'm Johnny Jenkins. I'm with Aidan McGurran, who now is on Basildon Council, but rose to be the managing editor of the newspaper, The Daily Mirror. Sinead O'Connor there, someone who's been in the tabloids her whole life.
Well, and she was great tabloid copy. I mean, you know, incredibly controversial figure. Mentioned the ripping up the picture of the Pope. I mean, people forget, you know, just what a fuss that caused at the time. You know, so, and she was, you know, she was always up to something. Very rebellious, though. Very intelligent young woman. Not always right, but always... always willing to make a point, always willing to raise her head above the parapet, and very involved in the peace movement in Ireland as well, which in Ireland didn't always make her popular either.
The tabloids are always attracted to just big characters, aren't they? Big personalities, and with an element of being divisive, but everyone's just sort of addicted to buying papers with their faces on.
Yeah, it's you want a character. I mean, bland personalities don't sell newspapers, generally speaking. And you like provoking opinion as well. So yeah, it fits in. The two fit together very nicely.
I promise we'll get back to the paper management in a moment. But I remember when I, as a teenager, spent some time in the Mirror, thanks to you. Mm-hmm. And someone said to me, Princess Diana will always sell a paper because she was on the front page and she'd been long dead. And I was, I can't remember what the story was that led her to be on the front page. And I was slightly confused at the time as a newbie as to why you'd be looking back so much. But she was one of those characters.
Oh, no question about it.
The character, maybe.
No question about it. Of that era, yeah, absolutely. I mean, it became a standing joke that around about that time, the Daily Express in particular, one day a week, that would always have Princess Diana on the front page. I can't remember which day, but it became known as Diana Day. you know, so, but because, but the reason was, you know, and it sounds quite cynical, it is quite cynical in a way, that they knew the readers would respond to that, they'd get a bit of a sales bounce out of it. You know, I remember you're probably a little bit too young when Princess Diana died, and it was extraordinary, and it also posed a massive threat to the royal family at the time until they got their act together.
Mm. And this is all in the picture of we now know circulation, so sales of papers is desperately low, but that's why you're trying to sell so many, because you know you're fighting against the tide of people not picking up. So when did you first sense that people weren't buying the papers as much?
I think probably from about 2000 onwards, really. I mean, I'll give you the figure for the Mirror in 2000 and then 2020. So in 2000, the Daily Mirror was selling almost 2.3 million a day. By 2020, it was 451,000. That's an 80% decline. Now, that's mirrored, no pun intended, across most of the papers. There's one or two booked the trend a bit, but that's generally the case. So it was a very so when I came into editorial management in 2009, you know, that was the general background, and then you've got an economic crisis that's hammering your advertising revenue as well, and the rise of the internet as well, which poses its own problems, because it gives advertisers somewhere else to go, it means people can get the news elsewhere, all the rest of it. So it was, yeah, it was a bit of a perfect storm.
And you're having to then, I suppose, think about an online operation and how you might get ad sales on that as well.
Absolutely. And that's interesting. So on the one hand, you're trying to cut your print editorial costs, but you're also trying to invest into your online operation, which means that the cuts to the print side of the operation are even greater than they would be. And also, you're struggling in an online environment that you don't really understand, that you're not expert in, and that... you know, there are competitors already there, and you've also got, you know, debates about can we charge for this or do we have to give it away? And Alan Brusbridger of The Guardian was not universally popular with newspapers because he decided very early on it was all going to be free. He was going to move largely from print to digital. The difference was he had £6 billion of a charitable trust behind him. We were commercial operations, so it was a bit more of a challenge for us than for him.
And I suppose as among the print journalists, there's a sense of frustration that they're now having to do the online stuff probably as well as the print stuff, and taking up more of their attention.
Massively. But that took a while, actually, because the antagonism was so much that in the early days, we didn't even expect the print journalists to do any of the online stuff. We had dedicated online. Over the years that went on, that changed, and now it's the regional papers took the lead. They went online first years ago, and the national news papers followed, but there's still a debate on how do we make this work. How do the classic expression was, how do we monetize it? Because what we've seen over the years, and it's still largely the case, is that when it came to revenues from print products, you were talking pounds, and when it was coming from revenues from online digital products, you were talking pennies.
More and more now, there's premium content online. If you go on the big website, the Mail Online, a lot of it is you need to have an account or pay some money for that. I suppose that's where it's going now.
That's where it's going if you can charge for it. But again, it's got to be premium content. It's got to be something people are prepared to pay for. So, some of the niche products, the Financial Times, for instance. Brilliant, because that's something that people will pay for, because it's usually business accounts paying for it anyway. So that's a Mail Online. Mail, again, privately owned outfit, invested a lot of money, over a lot of years, and you can see the difference. Whatever you think of the Mail as a product, in terms of political, etc., in terms of what it actually gives the consumer, it's a very, very good product. You might not like some of the content, but there's a lot of it. It's high quality, etc., etc. So it depends what you're given. I mean, I've always felt that Daily Mirror made, and I said it at the time, and I've said it ever since, made a massive mistake early on, in that what defined the Daily Mirror was its sort of left of centre campaigning basis, and I felt there was room there to go more political in an online environment, and they didn't do it. The received wisdom was no one wants that. Blah blah blah. We've now seen a proliferation of progressive left-wing campaigning online digital offers, and the Mirror missed the boat.
And the Mirror website now is just...
It's a dog's dinner.
Yeah, I mean, it's awful.
Yeah, it's a dog's dinner. I think it's having yet another revamp. And like when I say it's awful, I should stress, I'm not criticising anyone there, because I do know...
It's how it's made. Yeah. It's the adverts, the pop-ups. You can't read anything.
I mean, that's the problem. So again, they're trying to monetise it by doing a ridiculous... maximising the amount of pop-ups and that. But then, in terms of the user experience, it becomes awful. So I'm not criticising the staff who I know are working really hard and doing the best. But it's like... they're still struggling with a way to make it financially viable and make it work. And it's not helped by things like Facebook the other a year or two ago decided that they were moving away from news content, which massively reduced the income stream to Mirror Online and other online news, particularly tabloid news offerings. So it's a really difficult market. But there is yet another revamp of the online. I hope they get it better this time.
All right, we'll see how it goes. Let's move to the topic then, phone hacking, because that's something which has been in and out of the courts ever since, and recently we've seen Prince Harry settling out of court, Hugh Grant as well, probably the two main figures around all of this. And seemingly they're having to settle out of court because the law is really weird in that area, that even if they won, it would still cost them millions.
Yeah, I think the whole thing with phone hacking is there's lots of contradictions, and the whole thing about civil law versus criminal law as well makes it very complicated and very expensive. The strange thing about phone hacking is, people think it was an explosion around about the time the News of the World closed, it's gone on ever since. It was kind of rumbling away in the background for quite a while. I mean, I think from about 1995 onwards, people were vaguely aware of what was going on, or beginning to become aware. But it was only when Clive Goodman, who was the royal editor of the News of the World, was arrested and jailed for hacking a member of the royal household's phone, I think 2006, 2007, it really began to gather momentum. The Guardian got on, started looking into it quite significantly. And then in 2011, the News of the World shut, which was just, again, monumental. The biggest selling Sunday newspaper in the country, forced to close. And we've seen, it's gone on and on ever since.
So when this was first happening, and I mean, the journalists or the private investigators who are doing it are probably thinking, wow, I've struck gold because I can get these unbelievable stories. No one's asking me where they came from and no one really knows about phone hacking. So they're having a field day making loads of money. How much awareness of that is there in the newsroom? Do journalists know that other journalists are tapping phones?
So for most of this period, I was out in the east of England, so I was a little bit removed from it. And I think there was only far less awareness than you would think, on the whole. Because I think, again, the News of the World, it became a sort of cottage industry. I mean, it was, like, ridiculous. They were hacking everything. Certainly in terms of what I subsequently discovered about the Mirror, because I wasn't particularly aware of at the time, was it was largely, almost entirely related to the showbiz reporting. And that's not to say all showbiz reporters were doing it, but the showbiz reporters that were doing it on a very large scale. But I would take issue with one of the things, and I think people think that all these stories were amazing. I did some work subsequently to try and get to grips with what was going on and what had gone on. And I think one of the depressing things is a lot of them were really not that great, and like Z-list celebrities that like no one was especially bothered about. But it just became what some journalists did. That was the, you know, the rationale. That was what they did. And interestingly as well, I think when it very first started, which often happens with a new technology, I don't think the legislation had actually caught up with it. So for a year or two, it wasn't illegal. Now, that doesn't justify anything, obviously. But I think the trouble is it took such deep roots so quickly that people just carried on. And like you say, it was like, it was easy to do, yielded results, and people thought, well, we're going to get away with it.
So do you think the problem there is that people aren't asking where the stories came from?
I think there was an element of that. I think it depends. It's difficult to know categorically, because I think there was an element of not wanting to know, and there was an element of some newspaper executives knowing full well what was going on, but pretending they didn't.
Mm. So you've ever hacked a phone?
I've never hacked a phone, no.
Did you know?
At that time, I had difficulty operating a mobile phone, never mind hacking one.
Did you know it was going on?
Like I say, only vaguely. Because like I say, I was, you know, most of that time, not all of it, most of that time, I was like an East of England district reporter covering news in a traditional knocking on door sort of way. So I was vaguely aware of it. We talked about SOME a lot last time. I do remember vaguely the police getting very agitated during the SOME inquiry about the News of the World. Mm. And that was probably the first time it really came on my radar. But, you know, it, like I say, it was really the Clive Goodman arrest and subsequent prosecution in 2006-07 where it really come on the radar. You know, which may sound naive, and maybe I was naive, I don't know. But I certainly had to get to grips with it subsequently anyway.
I think the whole industry was probably naive.
Yeah, I think there was an element of naivety. And there was probably an element of, you know, everyone hates the tabloid newspapers. You know, there's a bit of, you know, we are Millwall, you know, we don't care. You know what I mean? It's kind of like a little protected industry. But having said that, what's fascinating as well is when it all came out, I subsequently talked to people in other industries, and there was a select committee hearing that went nowhere that discovered all sorts of, like, the insurance industry, property, all sorts of other industries were doing it as well. Now, I'm not saying, therefore, that they should have all been prosecuted or we shouldn't, but it'd be, again, naive to think if newspapers were doing it, no one else was doing it.
Let's do a song, and then we'll talk about the the fallout and, mm-hmm. and how the industry now is still reeling from it. The song's called Young, Gifted and Black, and why have you picked this one?
It's a song from my youth. It really is a song from my youth. It's a great tune. It's kind of civil rights, black power anthem. And interestingly, this version is the one I was familiar with. What I didn't know at the time was it was actually written by Nina Simone, who I featured a track of last time as well.
There we go. It all comes back
around.
Gifted and Black is where it's at. This is Gateway 97.8. I'm Johnny Jenkins. This is My Life in Print, the second part with Aidan McGurran, who now is a Basildon councillor but was the managing editor of the Daily Mirror. You were a councillor whilst you were at the Mirror as well, weren't you?
For a period when I was deputy managing editor, I was, yeah. And then when I got promoted to managing editor, just didn't have the time.
Was it ever a conflict of interest to do both?
I don't think so, really. I mean, it was a conflict of time more than a conflict of interest. But I don't remember that there being an issue there. And most people at the Mirror are quite supportive. And I think, you know, given I was sort of management at that point, it sort of reassured some of my colleagues that I hadn't gone over to the dark side completely.
And you were open about it as well. You would.
Oh yeah.
There would be columns about, you know, yeah. I'm out on the campaign trail.
Yeah. And obviously, you know, I had to get permission to do it before I did it as well in case the company felt that there was any issues with, or management felt there was any issues with. But that, no, that was never a problem.
Okay, let's come back to our topic of phone hacking, which has been going through the courts again recently. So we all know it's happened and we can all agree it's bad, and we can all agree that in some cases lives were completely ruined by it. I've been speaking to people in the last few weeks who hacked, and still they haven't spoken about it now or don't feel they can talk about it. They don't want the attention that comes with it. just the sheer volume of it, so many people affected.
Yeah, it should never have happened. It should never have happened. There's no justification. And even before it was criminal, it was immoral. I accept that in some instances it did cause great personal suffering to the individuals and the families. Because, what would happen would be, obviously, if you know there's only a few people know about something, you immediately start pointing the finger at family and friends and thinking it's their fault. However, at the risk of being, and I don't want to be too controversial, the amount of payouts that have been received, not to individuals, but the sheer volume, that it's very difficult to prove a civil case. So you're basically proving a negative that you didn't do something rather than you did do something. So I know that there are individuals who receive payments for stories where hacking was not involved, but it became... if you featured in the newspapers during that period, then lawyers would contact you. Do you want to put in a claim? Well, what does that involve? It involves you getting a nice check at the end of it. Oh, okay, I'll put in a claim. Now, again, that doesn't, that's not justifying anything, but it's the other side of the story, the narrative that we don't really hear it much.
And part of this as well is reporters hacking other reporters to nick stories, right? So yeah. I know a reporter who is... moving in the same circles as you at the same time, and he knows for a fact that his phone was hacked because he'd see his stories in the other papers that he knew only he had.
I mean, this is where it gets really ridiculous. And it would be laughable if the consequences weren't so serious. But I mean, and again, one of the other things that again never really surfaced, and I think was kind of covered up a bit, it wasn't just newspapers that were doing this. If you think, if you can hack someone's phone and get a competitive edge, whatever industry you're in, there's going to be an element of that. It did happen. So part of me, have no problem with the fact that the prosecutions took place and what all the rest of it. But again, and I'm not saying I want prosecutions in other industries, that's not going to happen, but it does seem newspapers were singled out in a way that other industries weren't.
It must have been almost like a tidal wave through the sector as everyone is realising this is happening, and people, the public as well, are hating tabloids even more.
Yeah, no, I think that's it. I mean, in terms of the financial consequences, which I'll talk about in a minute, that I think two things happened. That a lot of the trust of the readers in the paper was eroded by that. There's no getting away from that. You can't be, you can't be being all over the TV news and whatnot, broadcast news about phone hacking and the extent of it without that having some impact on the trust of your readership in you. And also what it meant, which was also unfortunate, was that the senior management, the PLC management of what became Reach PLC, trust in its editorial staff was eroded even further. So it made it even easier for them to ignore us. And when we were saying about editorial standards and needing to preserve editorial jobs, they were just going, ignore them. They lied to us before. Why should we listen to them?
That's really tough, isn't it?
Yeah, that was really tough, yeah. Because in the early days of trying to clear up the mess after phone hacking, myself and my colleague Eugene Duffy were quite involved in it, and all of a sudden it was like we were sidelined, and it was the lawyers and the very senior management that were involved. And people were asking us what's going on about this, and we're going, can't say, I have no idea, we don't know anymore.
And there's a hell of a lot of mess to clear up.
You've got to clear
the name of the paper, okay. And newspapers, yeah, more widely,
which is very difficult. One of the worst things that happens to a business is serious reputational damage, and like I say, in terms of the News of the World closing, it doesn't get much more serious than that. The News of the World was the best-selling newspaper, Sunday newspaper in the country. It was incredibly profitable, and it was closed overnight. I mean, that's pretty brutal. Hundreds of people lost their jobs as well, and I know a lot of people will go, well, they deserved it. What you've got to remember is, as well as editorial jobs, there's a lot of non-editorial jobs, there's admin jobs, there's finance jobs, there's advertising jobs. None of those people were involved in it, but all of those jobs went as well.
Did you ever think that your paper might have to shut?
I thought it was unlikely, but I thought it would... What I thought it would do was hasten the demise of the print paper, as opposed to it would have to shut in the way that News of the World shut. So up until now, the Mirror Group newspapers have spent over £100 million in legal costs and damages. Now, that's at a time when you're taking tens of millions each year out of the budget, and that's another 100 plus million you've got to find from somewhere. to be fair, that pales into insignificant compared to newsgroup newspapers who publish the Sun Times and Sunday Times. The bill for them is over £1 billion. So this is, you know, extraordinary, unprecedented amounts of money.
Where's it even coming from, that sums of money? You're saying, you know, you're struggling to get advertisers to keep the paper going. I mean, one columnist or 10 reporters is nothing compared with that.
Well, I mean, the weird thing is, because of all the cuts and you know, and creative energy at the at Mirror Group, you know, they still make a profit. They make, you know, now it's not anything like the profit it used to be. It's not anything like the profit they want to be making, but they still make a profit. In terms of newsgroup newspapers, you know, they're part of the Murdoch empire. They've got very deep pockets indeed. And a cynic could say that, you know, they'll keep paying it if it protects the people at the very top.
That feels to be the case at the moment with the newsgroup newspapers, aka The Sun and those titles. There's a lot of protection of those who are now in managerial positions who were pretty senior in the paper at the time.
Yeah, I think what happened again, particularly at newsgroup, as we spoke about at Mirror and the senior management, it was even more so at The Sun, News of the World, because what seemed to be happening was if the foot soldiers were being arrested and charged, that was okay, but they were never going to let it come to beyond that. That said, you know, people forget that Andy Coulson, who was News of the World editor, then worked for David Cameron, was jailed, but it stopped there. Now, I don't know, you know, it's not for me to say, I don't know, they've got very good lawyers, whether people above and beyond that should have faced investigation more than they did. But there was definitely a feeling amongst the staff at News Group newspapers, they'd been abandoned, that it was, you know, they'd been hung out to dry, but the really, really senior executives were being protected.
Let's just reflect on Andy Coulson, seeing as you mentioned him there, and the nature of his arrest and prosecution. He's working for David Cameron at the time.
Yeah.
He's in the heart of power,
yeah,
and sort of became the story and had to disappear.
Yeah. No, I mean, it is extraordinary. You know, people talk about fall from grace. That's quite really up there. You know, and he was working for David Cameron, and David Cameron has said that, you know, he was satisfied that Andy Coulson had not been involved in phone hacking, that he'd had the conversation with him, that all the rest of it, and then events unfurled, you know. So not only is it, you know, a personal tragedy for Andy Coulson, but it's very damaging for David Cameron as well.
So when you're thinking about the clean-up, if I can put it that way, where do you even look first? Where do you start?
You start by telling members of the editorial staff, whatever has gone on before, whatever you have done, stops now. It doesn't ever happen again. You start with that. And then you start to look. I mean, I remember doing a piece where we looked at a lot of papers going back years and years to see how prevalent we thought it was. And it became apparent that it was alarmingly prevalent.
Is this in like every paper? Would it be that common?
Well, I mean, I can only speak for the Mirror title.
No, sorry, what I mean is, would there have been something that linked back to phone hacking in sort of every edition?
No, it wouldn't be as common as that, but it would be alarmingly common, yeah. Yeah, so, you know, we were hoping it would be, you know, containable. So, you know, in terms of when it came, because we knew where it was going in terms of there would be civil cases, there would be damages, but it quickly became apparent that it was worse than we had realised, and certainly way, 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 way worse than we could have hoped for.
And how can you be sure that it's not still happening when you're in that position then? So you say to your journalists, don't ever do this again. You can't just trust them. There's got to be...
You can't be entirely sure. And like I say, it becomes so deep-rooted, certainly in certain aspects of the industry, that you can't be sure. I mean, all I would say, after, you know, it resulted in the Leveson inquiry, which was a massive investigation into phone hacking and newspaper practices generally. All I would say, anyone who continued to do it after that would be, in my view, clinically insane.
Mm. Because they could see the consequences of what happened.
Yeah, you can see the consequences. So, like, you know, are you really, you know, for whatever story, going to risk your entire livelihood, go into jail, and by that time, given, you know, the warnings have been issued, probably go into jail for quite a long time, you know, are you really going to risk it for that?
So tell me a bit more about the clean-up. So you tell your folks, don't do it again. You look through the papers, then what?
Well, then, I mean, unfortunately, when it became apparent that it was far more prevalent than... around about the same time, we had a new chief executive of what was then Trinity Mirror, became Reach PLC, come in. And I think once he began to appreciate the extent of the problem, as I said earlier, basically removed all members of editorials, be it editorial management, whatever, from the process, and then it became a legal and really senior executive management issue. So we were became bystanders, if you like.
So you never had to be in a courtroom watching what was happening to your paper at the time?
I was lucky in that I never... my predecessor, Eugene, had to give evidence at the Leveson Inquiry because he was still managing editor then, so I didn't have to do that. Only one or two former Mirror people charged over phone hacking. I never had to give evidence in court, but I did attend court when the police then moved on to payment of public officials, which I think we'll come to.
Let's do that now then. Right. So that was another big problem, which isn't really spoken about as much.
No, and I think I think there's reasons for that, quite valid reasons really. In terms of phone hacking, it's clear that it shouldn't have happened. It was criminal, albeit you can debate, in the overall level of criminality where it lies. But in terms of payment of public officials, it's highly debatable if it was even illegal. So the received wisdom in newspaper offices, editorial offices at the time, was if you were paying someone you were aware was a public official, you would contact your legal department. They would talk you through the story, ascertain whether there was a public interest justification, and if there was, they would go, "That's okay." If there wasn't, they'd advise against you running it, and that was the received wisdom. Unfortunately, because after the whole phone hacking thing, then the police got a lot of criticism. Police and CPS got a lot of criticism for not having acted earlier, which, some people say entirely understandable. So then it was I think the police became overzealous and started looking at other areas in terms of the payment of public officials, which, like I say, there was something like 34 convictions. And only one led to a journalist. Only one led to a successful conviction, and that was overturned. But I do feel quite passionate because I know some of the people involved. First off, the homes were raided by the police first thing in the morning. Personal stuff was taken away, and then they were left for months, sometimes a year or two on air, to wait to find out if they're going to be prosecuted or not. If they're prosecuted, they then had to wait longer to go to trial. An enormous burden on something that I, to this day, don't think did it wrong. Questioned the morality of it, but in terms of criminality, I don't think there's anything wrong with it. And certainly that's what the jurors decided. They couldn't convict in any of these cases.
All of those lives were ruined, certainly for a period of time.
And, some more than a period of time. A former colleague of mine had moved out of tabloid newspapers, was working in public sector PR, lost his job, and for quite some time didn't know if he was going to get any financial legal support from his former employer, who eventually did. But you can imagine the stress and turmoil that causes.
And who are these public officials? Forgive my ignorance. I mean, who is it that is supposedly being paid?
So, and to be fair, it wasn't always supposedly. Sometimes they were being paid. So, it could be prison officers, police officers, paramedics, anyone who worked in the public sector, basically. So, because the feeling was they were given information that they shouldn't have been in terms of their job. Now, again, that's a bit murky, but in terms of the journalist was just doing their job. And what's interesting is it was the prosecutions were based on a law that was kind of case law. It wasn't statutory law, and it case law gets built over the years, but it kind of dates back to 1783, the original case, which I know very little about. I'm not going to pretend I do. But and interestingly, yourself, you have this Bible of law that you have to learn as a trainee journalist called McNay's Essential Law for Journalists. At that time, it wasn't even mentioned in there. And like I say, most of these journalists, if not all, when they were running these stories, would have spoke to their legal department and said, is this okay? And the legal department would have said, yeah, because there's a public interest justification.
In a moment, we're going to talk about the future of print. The public interest thing, though, I just want to mention that for a moment, because it's not necessarily what the public is interested in. It is, it's a technical thing, isn't it,
yes.
The public interest?
Yeah.
And you're weighing that up with every story you're working on.
That's right. And lawyers would sometimes take great pleasure in going, Aidan, just because, you know, it's interesting to the public doesn't really... You know what lawyers like.
Yeah.
They get all hoity-toity about it. But, yeah, no, that's right. It is a completely different thing. And, you know, and to be honest, some of the stories that appeared probably... had slightly dubious public interest justification. Most of them did, but some of them didn't. But interestingly, just give you a little anecdote before we move on. So when all these arrests were taking place, like I said, they were usually 5:30, 6 o'clock in the morning. It suddenly occurred to me that although I, to the best of my knowledge, hadn't made any payments myself, under the payment authorising system, because I'm editorial management, I had authorised one that led to an arrest of one of my colleagues. So I thought the next logical step is they... go up the next rung up the ladder, which, well, who authorised these payments? And so I could be getting the police raid up 6 o'clock in the morning. My daughter at the time was about 14, is quite both sensitive and feisty at the same time. And I thought, I'd better tell her because, you know, that'd be quite upsetting. And so I said, I don't think this is going to happen, but there's a slight chance that it could. And she said, what, you could be arrested? I went, yeah, well, it's unlikely, it could be. And she went, I won't say what she exactly said because there's a swear word involved. She said, that's so cool, Dad. Can I go on Facebook and tell all my mates? I was going, no.
Whatever you do.
You absolutely cannot go on Facebook and tell all your mates.
Last few minutes together now. How long will a print edition of the Daily Mirror be available to buy?
You know what, that's a great question. That's a really great question. And I wish I could answer it. But I think all I would say is that, you know, all the predictions... So if you go back to my time I started in editorial management... I mean, I think, in fact, even before I started in editorial management, we'd done a piece of work, my predecessor had done a piece of work on the Sunday People and trajectories in terms of circulation, advertising revenue. I think they thought that the Sunday People go out of business about 2012.
Still going.
I mean, admittedly, yeah. Circulation was falling off a cliff, but still going. Newspapers can be surprisingly resilient. Now, are they going to last forever? No. Some might, but no. But I think I said last time, I love newspapers. I want them to continue in a printed form for as long as possible. But I think the main thing is we have reliable news available to the public, whether that's at a cost, free, whatever, so that a business model that supports that. But also, it's got to be, you know, good value news, and we've got to learn from the mistakes of the past and collect our news in a way that's responsible, legal and moral.
And will the online side of things, will it ever be sort of profitable enough on its own? It's hard to say.
I mean, some of it already is. Some of it already is. But it's like I say, the trouble with online, you know, it's there's so much of it. There's such a profusion of it. And it's hard to charge for something that people are used to having for nothing. It's really hard to charge. So you know, to be fair, it'll be interesting to see with Mail Online, you know, the mail subscription service, how that continues to do. I just want, whether it's the Mail, whoever, you know... news to be available, properly research resourced, proper journalism to be available. And I think it will always be the case. It's just I haven't got a crystal ball, so I don't know, sure. Quite know how that's going to pan out. But I think, like I say, and what's interesting about newspapers, print newspapers, is they have been far more resilient than we would have thought. I mean, all the, you know, if you talk to all the commentators, the media experts in the sort of mid-2000s, late 2005, 2009, they'd have said virtually none of the national newspapers would be existing anymore. And they are. Might be struggling a bit, but they are.
And you still get a paper?
I do.
Just the Mirror, or do you pick up any others?
I normally buy the Echo as well these days, and I'm a big fan of the Sunday Times as well, because it's a great product.
Okay, we've got time for one more song, but I've got two here, so you can pick which one you want. You can either have Kneecap or Sex Pistols.
Oh, you know what? Because I had John Lydon public image last time, I'll go for Kneecap, because I've not had any contemporary tunes so far.
Kneecap, they've been pretty controversial in the news as well.
Well, again, so I think John Lydon did approve of going for a controversial choice. Yeah, I must admit, until a few months ago, I was vaguely aware of them, and then both my son and a very good friend of mine said, you've got to watch Kneecap, the movie. And if you've not seen it, watch it. It's not family viewing, I have to say, but really, really funny, very entertaining, and just a great watch.
Aidan, thanks very much for joining me for My Life in Print on Gateway 97.8. Kneecap with Sick in the Head.
Two bags of street is the same price as an hour of therapist. No wonder we're all fucked up.
I tell you what, sorry, that's a great point.
I got a point to be proven to myself. Sitting too long, getting moldy on the shelf, cause I'm too far gone when it comes to mental health. I'd be sick in the head with a little bit of wealth. Time I tend to write a glottic cool stanchera. My time can the yen and they need to sit down to rap. I give me light but not get shit we can't check out. Never go to be a guest like a show am I.
Shots to geek, to your doing, yeah, they're doing it to you constantly. An individual is surely what you want to be. You're born to sound good, live your fantasy. Before they eat you up, riskier than lethargy. Flan sucker, BG, Grisakas, clean it off, flan mucker. They'll be pushbacks, but relax, shocker. Cause shoulders feel set, they heal into on brothers.
It's a philosophy, me like I'm gone, don't worry. I'll go to them, or an ear, heal a power, and TV Steve. To be a fact for me, because Khabibra, Talat, all of it. So it's how it's meant to be, so got your cover. Clean out hands, now here's the hand fucker. Be Higgins here, toss her, Murray Higgins, toss her, toss her. They're huge at the cost her, so talk, shine, shine, score. New machine is fucker.
I got a point to be proven to myself. Sitting too long, getting moody on the shelf. Cause I'm too far gone when it comes to mental health. But I be sick in the head with a little bit of wealth. Time I tend to wait, I got a coolie stranger. My time came to yen and they need to sit down to rest. I give me life and I can shoot me, can't check out. Now I go to pay a guest, I can show them all.
I prayed to the devil, let me be rich instead. He said,
you'll no longer be skin, but you'll be sick in the head. Need way too real, so shrajina. I'll go get to be fibina. You want this for naginus of rest when you're pissed?
Yes.
You're a ma comp makara.
Sound, I'll be back for a fat loan tomorrow. That's me never getting dressed. Depressed and always para. Throwing tantrums in my mansion, am I embarrassed?
Got shots, come and get the bugger mirror. Kneel and dirt, my delonta is macabre. Earth straight, insecure moments, smoking numbers, smoking till it's all done, all gone. No hard magic till it's all known. But we're making up our own laws. Never getting worried about our own flaws. Fuck a real job, we make our own boss. Kneecap, tree cap, we're our own gods.
I got a point to be proven to myself. Sitting too long, getting moody on the shelf. Cause I'm too far gone when it comes to mental health. But I be sick in the head with a little bit of wealth. I'm a gender, but I got a cool distance.
There's more ways to listen to Gateway 97.8. We're online at gateway978.com via the radio player. Hear us on the Android app from the Play Store. Hear us on the Apple app from the Apple Store. Tune in. And on your TV with the MyTuner app. We're also on 97.8 across Basildon and East Thurrock. Yeah. Gateway 97.8. Your local. In tune with the community. On your mobile apps, on 97.8, and now on DAB. This is Gateway.
From the